Well, the thesis in favor of which I should like to argue is the following one. A theism has failed, hence it is doomed to disappear in the long run. That's quite a cheeky thesis, and I have to argue for it, but first of all against it, in the old way of the scholastic questio disputata. You first have to say, apparently, things are not as I want them to be. That's the videtur quod non. And well, my task will consist in bringing this fact, i.e. the failure of a theism, to consciousness, and to draw the consequences that it brings about. As far as I'm concerned, and in teeth of what I've just been saying, I often get the impression of belaboring the obvious. But the problem is precisely that the majority of our contemporaries don't accept to face it. And I could even say that we live among various attempts at camouflaging the fact. The people who do that are excusable because we are tempted to utter against my thesis, as I told you, a powerful videtur quod non. Apparently, that's the contrary. And it would be more accurate to speak of a triumphal march of a theism. This is the way in which many atheists see the situation. For many polls show that the number of church attendance is plummeting, at least in Europe, particularly in my native country, France. In any case, in countries that bear the stamp of Christianity. To be sure, religions know today an unexpected comeback, especially in their most radical forms. For instance, in the most spectacular, because violent way in Islam, but in Hinduism as well. And this happens also in a more peaceful guise in groups such as the Haredim in Judaism or in Christianity among the so-called evangelical Christians. The answer of atheists is ready. All this are rearguard battles. The progress of science and of technology that is narrowly linked up with it brings about irresistibly a secularization of life. We atheists only have to be patient. Europe is the avant-garde. The rest of the world will follow suit. What lends this hope some grade of plausibility is the fact that on the level of society, atheism apparently is carrying the day. In the Thoughts on the French Affairs that he wrote as soon as December 1791, Edmund Burke, the well-known Irish philosopher and politician, Burke made the point that atheists have given up their traditional bashfulness and shifted to a more outspoken and even more provocative attitude. Quote, boldness formerly was not the character of atheists as such, but of late they are grown active, designing, turbulent, and seditious. Today, unquote. Today, he would express himself more forcefully. For among the leading minds of late modernity, there were many atheists who advertised for their unbelief and attacked religion. The name of Marx, of Nietzsche, of Freud are in all memories. Today we have to do with people whose intellectual quality is not a match against the thinkers whom I have just mentioned. But they are noisier and they receive the mass media a larger echo. Furthermore, and those are the two elements of the videtur quod non that I'd like to express, furthermore, spectacular successes are very much to the credit of atheism. Let me mention two examples, one from the theoretical realm and one from the practical one. On the theoretical level, modern physical science, written in mathematical language as Galileo had it, succeeded in putting forward a description of reality that has no need of the God hypothesis, to allude to the well-known dialogue between the astronomer Laplace and Napoleon. Newton wanted a God who could from time to time correct the equations of his system, and Laplace had succeeded in describing a system of the world that did not require the intervention of God. The personal piety of many scientists doesn't play any part in this matter. When they do physics, they work without reference to God as, to quote Dietrich Bonhoeffer, God as a stopgap. And by this token, one need not religion, or no more religion, when one looks for an explanation of the world. That's the first fact that pleads in favor of atheism. The second one is to be found on the practical level. Modern political thought and modern political practice succeeded in showing that societies can organize themselves without a superhuman principle of legitimacy. As soon as 1682, the French philosopher Pierre Bayle, by the way, perhaps this could make sense for me to write some names. Pierre Bayle defended his famous paradox, according to which a theism is not more dangerous for the state than superstition. He even contended that a society of atheists would be more docile than one of religious enthusiasts. Our present-day societies, made of this intuition or of this wager, a concrete reality, each in its own style, from the American wall of separation to our French sacred cow, the laïcité, and so on and so forth. There's a whole spectrum of ways for societies to separate from a religion. Be that as it may, on balance, we may conclude that in order to orient ourselves in the material world, such as physical science reveals it to us, and in order to orient ourselves in social organization, we need no religion, no God. Therefore, some sort of a theism is possible. Which sort? Let me make two observations on this kind of a theism. First, it is not necessarily militant, not necessarily belligerent. It exists first and foremost as a methodological principle that the divine must be put into brackets. The word agnosticism was coined exactly for this purpose by the English natural scientist and indefatigable advocate of Darwin's doctrine of evolution, famous bulldog Thomas Huxley. In Victorian England, atheism was hardly the thing. Therefore, in the course of a discussion held in 1869 at the Metaphysical Society, Huxley suggested that his own position, he extemporized, you know, he coined the word in the heat of the debate, his own position should be named agnosticism. Second point. Agnosticism is not a stance that concerns religious questions only. For the same modesty and soberness are to be found when what is at stake is our knowledge of physical phenomena. In the very realm of physics, some sort of agnosticism obtains as well. The positivism of Auguste Comte and of Claude Bernard makes of the renunciation to an insight into the ultimate causes a basic principle. Scientific inquiry should content itself with expressing the relations that obtain between the phenomena in the most precise way with the help of mathematical language. Why what is what it is. Why it is how it is, science is not allowed even to ask, let alone to answer such a question. Well, in the teeth of all its successes, atheism, even in its mildest form, i.e. as agnosticism, contains a lethal drawback, a sickness unto death. For there is a question on which a theism hasn't anything to say. This fundamental question is, if we admit that there is on this earth a being known as Homo sapiens, and well, that's our humble selves. If we admit that there are on this earth men, i.e. beings that are able to give an account of the universe that surrounds him, able to do physics, and able to live peacefully with his fellow men, and if he's able to, in both cases, to do that without his having to look up towards any transcendent reality like a god, well, the question remains, would it be good that such a being should be and keep existing? To put it otherwise, we can sketch a merely immanent description of physical reality that enables human beings to conquer the world and to exploit it for their own advantage. We need not uncover the ultimate truth about reality as long as the description we make of it works. We can, on the other hand, set rules for the living together of the human beings in a merely immanent way. It is enough for us to conceive of a compact through which human beings lay on themselves the duty to spare each other because it is in their interest to do so. The German philosopher Kant even said that the political problem can be solved even in a society of devils, provided those utterly wicked beings are intelligent. Now, the ultimate goal of the mastery of nature through technology made possible by physical science, the ultimate goal of the social organization through politics, is that mankind should go on existing and even should improve its lot. But the question whether such an existence and or progress was something we should wish and foster remained unanswered and even not asked. For this question, a theism has no answer and can't have any. Well, in order to substantiate this rather risky claim, I must venture some words on the self-defeating character of a theism. I said self-defeating because the failure of a theism is a direct consequence of its very success. And this enables me to speak of a dialectics of a theism in the same meaning as in the well-known dialectics of enlightenment of the German philosophers Adorno and Horkheimer. Yet, whereas the masters of the School of Frankfurt remained on the level of ideas, we have to do here with a dialectics that could take utterly concrete features. Let me give here a brief outline of this dialectic. The project of modern atheism consisted in bringing about an emancipation of man. Man was to decide on his own destiny. He had to give his own law to himself, which we somehow loosely call autonomy. In former times, this was not the case. This was not even possible if we have to trust the way in which the modern project tells its own story. Man had in former times to set his life according to principles that lie outside of him. The overarching principle was in some cases the beautiful order of the cosmos. This is a phrase that boils down to a tautology, where the cosmos means precisely beautiful order. This principle was the beautiful order of the cosmos that man had to imitate. In other cases, it was a divine law which man had to go by. Well, it so happens that on each of those two possibilities, I have written a book that exists in an English translation, and thank you, Father, for mentioning them. The two points of reference, by the way, are intertwined, for the God who emits the commands is at the same time the God who gave the world its beautiful order. Now, modern times refuse more and more decidedly to look in those two directions, i.e. the direction of the cosmos and the direction of God. Their ideal would be to let man rest on a human basis only, so that any reference to an outside, to an other, to a higher would be excluded or even become meaningless. To put it as the young Karl Marx, who reflected about the adjective radical. Radical stems from the Latin word radix, which means root. And Marx added, well, the root for man is man himself. Man is his or her own root. The 19th century has minted for this ideal of radical autonomy a name that is to be read in the young Karl Marx himself, i.e. humanism. Now this humanism, precisely because it does not admit any higher instance than man, is unable to pass judgment on the value, or lack of it, of man as such. Man can't possibly speak either in favor of him or herself, or against him or herself. As a matter of course, it is very much likely that human beings would take a positive view of the existence of human beings. But such an acquittal would be utterly worthless, because you can't be judge and plaintiff at the same time. In a lecture that he gave right after the last World War, the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre brought this out by poking fun at an utterance of a poet. Well, the name is not important. The poet describes his reaction when he was sitting in a plane and flying over a chain of mountains. Well, he admired the landscape, but still more, the inventive mind of man capable of building aircraft. And he exclaimed, "Man is terrific." This may be true, but Sartre asks, who is speaking, who is passing judgment on the value of man? Certainly not a dog. Certainly not a horse. Hence, not an unbiased umpire, but a man. Now, it's clear that nobody can judge on himself objectively. But then I ask a question is this good that there should be human beings, one might pretty easily whisk away such a question as merely academic and a kind of a toy with which professional philosophers, professional armchair philosophers, play. This would be the case if two new elements had not been on the stage for some decades, or rather two sets of each time three elements. Let me look at them quickly. First set of elements. Human beings are at present in possession of the possibility of doing away with themselves. What is new is not the question of suicide, which was dealt with by the Stoics, for instance, and who answered in a positive way. What is new is that the problem of suicide has taken a collective dimension. The human species is now able to commit an all-encompassing suicide, for it possesses the means that could bring this about. Let me mention three of these means. First, since the beginning of industrialization, man has been spoiling the environment. This could lead to a situation in which the existence of man would become impossible. Second, since the discovery of atom energy and of its possible military use, mankind possesses the faculty to wipe itself out in a moment through an all-out nuclear war. Third, with chemical contraception, each generation can freely and without unpleasantnesses, let's add, can freely decide whether there will be a next one or none at all. This third possibility would be peaceful, piecemeal, hence hardly visible. In a long footnote to his Confession of the Curate of Savoy, Jean-Jacques Rousseau takes up the comparison that already had become hackneyed since Bayle, whom I mentioned, and already since Plutarch, since ancient Greece, the comparison between fanaticism and atheism. He rounds it up with a pithy formula, quote, "The principles of a theism don't cause the death of people, but they prevent them from being born," unquote. We may observe that atheistic regimes of the 20th century produced mass murders on a far larger scale than religious wars ever did, what Rousseau was fortunate not to know. But let us admit, for the sake of argument, that this be true, that atheism doesn't kill. Rousseau goes on, "To be sure, fanaticism lets blood flow, but it prompts people to great enterprises." That's a rather strange idea. On the other hand, and this is the point of his sayings, atheism, even if it does not kill anybody, reveals itself as being more lethal in the long run. So much for the first of the two newly occurred elements that change the terms of the problem. With the second one, we make a step further. Annihilation. Extinction of human beings. Annihilation that already had shifted from merely logical possibility to real possibility, this annihilation becomes a temptation. For and this is the second set of new facts, man calls in doubt his or her own legitimacy. We are not that sure that we are that good, that it is so good that there should be ourselves. 3 points of view again. First, human beings are not convinced any longer that they have the right to conquer and exploit the earth by means of technology. Second, human beings are not convinced any longer of their superiority, of their moral superiority over against the other living beings. On the contrary, the human species might be the worst of all predators. Third, human beings are not even sure that they distinguish themselves radically from other living beings by really different features. We read more often than not, well, we have 95% of our DNA in common with the higher apes like the chimp or the bonobo. There is no quality leap between men and, well, monkeys. Well, in front of those two new sets of facts, a danger arises for the very project of the Enlightenment. And the reason is the following one. We very well could content ourselves to imagine that survival instinct will look after man and ensure the existence of the human species. This may have been the case in former times, and at present, it is highly probable that man as a species will carry on existing in case there is no nuclear war and no radical poisoning of the planet, but this is another story. It is highly probable that man will go on existing because people will keep reproducing themselves, will keep getting children. But the German philosopher Schopenhauer in the 19th century already tried to show that sexual instinct is hardly more than a trap, a bait, through which the will to live fools us without giving a damn about the happiness of individuals. And the question has still to be answered. If we appeal to instinct in order to say, well, we need not bother, the instinct for survival will care for that. The trouble is that the appeal to instinct would do away with the whole project of enlightenment, and I don't mean thereby only the historical movement that became conscious of itself and chose this name in 18th century Europe. I mean the very project of philosophy in the whole breadth of its achievements. What is this project? Well, not doing anything without our being able to give an account of the reasons why we do what we do. That's what the Greeks called logon didonai, to reckon, to be able to present a book of reckoning in order. Every action without exception should be in principle justified by reasons, even if those reasons don't have to be totally conscious, totally explicit. But now, are we allowed to give up the quest for a ground, for a reason, when what is at stake is the very being of mankind, i.e. of this species that knows that a ground is required, that a reason is necessary. If we did that, we would have to face something unbearable. We would entrust the existence of the only being who can be the carrier of reason, we would entrust this existence to unreason. For instinct is something radically irrational. We meet here, or we would meet here, a paradox that was already pointed out on another level. The paradox at the other level is the following one. Natural science represents a fantastic triumph of reason. But at the same time, it claims to show that reason is merely a product, and an unintentional product, a so-called epiphenomenon of evolution. That is, of a movement that was led by blind and irrational forces. So that reason would be the result, the consequence of unreason. Well, this first paradox is still, well, rather difficult to swallow. But there is worse. And the second paradox is the one that we are facing at present, and with it we would be in a still worse predicament if reason stems from unreason, i.e. from irrational processes like selection of the fittest, survival of the fittest, natural selection, and so on and so forth. We can hardly reproach her for that. That's not her fault. But in the case that I am dealing with now, i.e. if reason freely surrendered to unreason, i.e. to instinct, it would sort of commit suicide and even high treason. Most concretely, and to step down from the realm of lofty metaphysical ideas, most concretely, we hear everywhere that the best way to hamper the population explosion that some people still fear is education, and especially school for girls. This may be true, but which is in any case above any doubt is that such a method is morally far superior to compulsory measures like sterilization. And, well, it is possible and even highly probable that such a method, such a soft method, works better too. But we can deduce from this observation a rather unpleasant consequences. The more intelligent, the more learned is a human group, the more barren it must be, or conversely, the more stupid and ignorant, the more fruitful. Present-day European demography furnishes us with an almost experimental proof of this equation. And it is probably not by chance that the decrease in birth rates affects Europe, perhaps the whole of Western world, and there the educated bourgeoisie, and in the rest of the world, in the formerly so-called third world, it affects the countries and the social classes that are supposed to be the most progressive, the most enlightened of all. Now, mind you, I'm not claiming that the shrinking of religious faith in Europe or elsewhere could be the cause of the lower birth rates. Looking for causes is already in itself a dubious endeavor. Historians are always reluctant to do that, to say, well, A is the cause of B. What is the cause of the First World War, for instance? Who knows? But admitted one does. One has to take one's bearing from the fact that such causes most probably are a tangled skein of factors that influence each other. And in order to see more clearly in this maze, one could and should mobilize sociology, psychology, economy, politics, all fields in which I have no competence whatsoever. Instead of that, I would like to draw upon a very old, a very classic distinction, the distinction between cause and ground, or reason, if you prefer. A fact has causes. An action has reasons. A cause explains what is the case already. A ground or a reason concerns what we can bring about in the future by our own doing. Finally, where does the lower birth rates among educated people come from, and where such a state of affairs leads is for me a matter of indifference. For what we desperately need here is not an explanation, but a reason for us to act. And we absolutely must be able to tell why the existence of men on this earth is a good thing. If the project of enlightenment, nay, if the project of philosophy at large, is to be successful, man needs a ground for man to go on existing. And to do that as man, in the full meaning of the term, as a rational and free being, as a being who can ask for the reason of what he does, and not only as, to quote Plato's well-known definition of man, not only as a biped without feathers. Man is badly in need of a point of reference that can legitimate his existence on the earth, which doesn't mean that such a fulcrum could legitimate each of the human whims, and certainly not the ruthless exploitation of the planet. The existence of a superhuman instance that can affirm the existence of the human species, that can say, well, it is good that there should be human beings, this is the very content of religion. And this instance is, to quote Aquinas' famous formula, what all people call God. Now, to be quite concrete and matter of fact, we need a category of human beings who can bring together in harmony faith, i.e. the reference to God, and reason, looking for grounds. We need it not in order to make human life more beautiful, not as an oil of sorts that could make social life easier, but in order to ensure the very continuation of the human adventure. This outlook is definitely conservative, but it doesn't endeavor to conserve a dominion, the domination of a social group over another one. It wants to ensure the conservation of humankind at large. And for this reason, it is more difficult to taunt such an attitude with ideological justification of a power. The question isn't any longer whether we can do without God. The question is, with what kind of God shall we have to live if we want mankind to live on? The God of the Bible and of the Christians is not the only possible one, hence the rather funny, ironical title of the book that was quoted, you know, on the God of the Christians and on one or two other gods. There are, besides the God of the Bible and of the Christians, the God of other religions, the God or gods in the plural of neo-pagan or para-pagan movements, and into the bargain, the God whom Pascal called the God of the philosophers and now the scientists. My very personal hunch is that the God of the Bible and of the Christians could be a very good candidate, but this is another story. Now, and I come to the end of my paper, you can be quiet, huh? As in a scholastic quaestio disputata, I have to answer the videtur quod non, the objections, the preliminary objections. I'll do that not exactly by refuting the claims of the first two objections, but by commenting upon them. As for the idea that science chases religion because it furnishes us with a better explanation of the world, well, it's dubious to understand religion in general as an explanation of physical phenomena. As such, there is little doubt that the scientific worldview is far more efficient. But when he's allowed to ask whether any religion ever intended to do that, to furnish an explanation of the physical phenomena, the empirical study of the worldview of the so-called primitive people shows, I'm referring to the works of Evans Pritchard, the British anthropologist, who studied in particular the Nuer in Sudan. Well, the study of those primitive peoples shows that they hardly care for the structure of the world, let alone for its causes or for the way it came into existence. That's not their problem. And in later religions, in very, well, sophisticated religion, one can say, one could quote utterances of the Buddha, who discarded every question of cosmology as useless, as indifferent. Or even, one could allude for that matter, to the chapter 2 of the treatise Haggigah in the Mishnah, in the Jewish Talmud, or part of the Talmud. Second, as for the possibility of building a social order without referring to transcendence, well, things have to be qualified, for not all religions want to foist on society a model of order. And in particular, Christianity distinguishes itself from the former so-called pagan religions and from other religions like Islam, insofar as Christianity doesn't impose on people other rules of conduct than the ones that natural, unaided reason either discovered or could have discovered. Christianity puts up with the Decalogue, with the Ten Commands, that are the basic survival kit of any human society. The principle, Christianity contents itself with what natural human reason, unaided reason, could have discovered. Whether human reason can gain an explicit knowledge of all that, that's a moot point. But in principle, it could have formulated, and in many cultures, it did formulate them. Now, this principle of subsidiarity of sorts explains at the same time why theism has some plausibility. For we have to account for the very possibility of a theism and even for its plausibility. Now it's the case that both can be deduced from the very character of the Christian God, so that theology explains the possibility of a theism. What makes a theism possible and even plausible is that God is not evident. It's not written on created beings made in God. To be sure, Saint Paul, at the beginning of the epistle to the Romans, claims that God should be known by natural reason. But the fact is that man doesn't acknowledge him as creator. And the fact is, in any case, that the knowledge of God, that we can elicit knowledge of his power and wisdom, that we can elicit from the study of natural beings, has to be the result of a work. We have to study things. It's not evident, it doesn't spring to the eye or to the mind that there is a creator. Well, in order to answer the question, why is it that God is not evident, we have to indulge in some anthropomorphism and ask, what are God's intentions? What is he driving at? Now, it's the case that God's aim is not to make himself known. What he wants is not his own glory, for his glory would be part of his own good. And now God does not have to look for his own good. He is the good. The good is not something that God has, but something that he is, which makes a big difference. What God wants is to give himself to his creatures, thereby producing the good of his creatures. Hence, it's enough for him to put creation at the disposal of his creatures. What we call God's glory is not his fame. God's glory is the very life of creation. A church father, Irenaeus of Lyons, 3rd century, has this wonderful formula: the glory of God is man alive. Gloria Dei vivens homo. God gives the creatures whatever is necessary for them to reach their own good. He reveals himself as such. He gives his name, if you want, this image, only when this is necessary for a creature to do that, i.e. to reach its good. And in the case of man, Irenaeus goes on in the same sentence, the life of man is the vision of God. Vita hominis visio Dei. Let me illustrate this with a parable. When asked by an unknown person in the street about the way, we answer. Okay, we say on the straight on, then you make your left, and the second on your right. Okay. But nobody would think of finishing by saying, well, by the way, my name is... Okay, straight ahead, second left, and I am Rémy Brague. Nobody would do that. I mean, nobody with a minimum of good education would do that. God does exactly the same thing. On the other hand, I would give my name, or perhaps even my card, with address, phone, email, if this can prove useful for the person, not for myself, but for the person. Well, if the person tells me, oh, could you please give me the address of a dentist? I happen to be a dentist. I give my card. I go to my practice. I'll treat you as soon as possible. This same thing with God. Revelation occurs, that God gives his name once again, if this can help us, if we really need the knowledge that he furnishes us with. Well, as a conclusion, I've been speaking for too long a time already, when I heard the title of my presentation, I haven't chosen it. Another phrase came to my mind, not the end of the line. That's a phrase that I didn't know, but the end of the tether. The end of the tether, to be at the end of one's tether. And well, I would like to round up my presentation with the evocation of two works that are entitled that way. The first is a little-known pamphlet published in 1945, right after the end of the last World War, by H.G. Wells. And it has the title of Mind at the End of Its Tether. The popular novelist and essay writer who for a long time had written utopias on the future of an enlightened mankind, freed from superstition by science and technology, bequeathed us in his old age, that's a testament of sorts, a gloomy view of the future. The only hope for Wells is that man should be replaced by an animal better fitted to the new conditions, unless a small minority of extremely pliable human beings can survive. The second work is the marvelous short novel or long story that Joseph Conrad published in 1902 under the plain title of The End of the Tether. Well, if you haven't read that, make a beeline to the nearest bookshop and read that. Captain Whalley, who is, once more, it takes place on a boat. There's many stories by Conrad, who was a former naval officer. Captain Whalley, who is losing his sight, must go on leading his ship till she finally suffers shipwreck. This might be read as a parable of the way in which a theism is steering Western culture. Thank you so much.